this week on The Inside Flap.
Well, you know, Haruki Murakami says that that you have to strengthen the body to write books. And he runs these marathons, and he's this crazy, incredible fitness regimen. You know, he swims, he bikes, he's a triathlete, marathon runner. And he writes these huge, huge books. You know, I write these little tiny, you know, less than 200-page things. So, you know, a couple sets of deadlifts and maybe an hour of walking a day is about as much strength as I need.
That's great. And you don't have to be very strong to lift your books, you know, also.
That's right. That's great.
Well, this woman, she says to me, and I wrote this down so I could get it just right. She says, I see you just saw the doctor today. And then she says, sorry to hear that. Are you all better?
Oh.
I'm like, what do you think? I just saw the doctor. I'm calling to schedule these appointments. Oh, no, I feel great.
That's
I just
weird.
Ran a second marathon.
Isn't that weird?
Today.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast, episode 178. My name is Dave Medicus, and thank you for joining us. Seated across the table to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And on the other side of the snack shack, resting not so comfortably on the floral settee as he is being pestered by Nelson, who's now got his nose right in Andrew's armpit.
Yeah. Well,
that's Andrew Dow. Yeah.
Excelsior, yeah. But... that's not the problem.
The problem was right before we got on the air.
It's almost like a flatulence competition between these two dogs. I don't know what you're feeding them, but I would switch.
Dog food!
Yeah, I would switch the formula.
I think it's a Charlie. He had surgery.
It's a Charlieism, yeah. He was bad before the surgery.
But the surgery, there's something about the surgery that he had.
It just got over here to the side of the side effect.
It didn't just get over here.
Woo! Okay, yeah. All right.
Well, and he's almost like human-like satisfaction, like a grin on his face and everything.
He stood
like,
there.
Yeah, check this one out.
He blasted you.
Oh, yeah.
And just, now he's laying down, got his tongue hanging out. He's
Charlie's
like,
feeling pretty good
job.
These days. He had a tumor removed or
That's
something
right.
removed, yeah. And he feels great now.
He feels great. Blast away. All right, we got a great show for you today. We're joined by Mohsin Hamid, twice nominated for the Booker Prize. His last book, Exit West, won the LA Times Book Prize. His new book that is out now, The Last White Man. Listen, this one's going to win all the prizes. This is an amazing book, and Mohsin is an amazing guest. I'm going to go ahead and call it the smartest guest we've ever had on the show.
Wow.
I wasn't on this call.
Right. I was on.
Holy cow.
I'm going to say this guy is the smartest guest
Dave
we've
comes
ever had.
In. I was like, how was it? And Dave just like gave me a nervous laugh, and he goes, like, he's the smartest person we've ever talked to.
I'm like, I feel so dumb.
Yeah.
Apologies to Dr. Joshua Bennett and, of course, our great friend Alma Katsu.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
She's got those CIA smarts. But
yeah, and Hernan Diaz, too. I thought he was one of the smarter ones I'd ever talked to.
Yeah.
So give me one example.
Well, no, you're going to listen to the interview, you're going to say, damn, Dave, you were right. The guy speaks in metaphors. Hmm. The guy speaks in metaphors.
Well,
he had an example and a story for every single question. Well, I'm glad. He's amazing. And he's funny. And he likes comedies. He's my new favorite guy. And listen, Mohsin, I know you're not listening. But if you were.
No, he's too smart to listen.
You're right. He's not going to listen to this dumb show. But if you're ever out here in Colorado, come on by.
Is he a sports fan, too?
We didn't get into sports.
Oh,
I was
come
not,
on!
I bet he's not.
Yeah, I don't know if he is or not.
Maybe
we did not get into sports.
Well, good
but,
for him.
I mean,
good
the guy's
him.
Favorite good movie is A Fish Called Wanda. That's you know.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, I feel like you know, smart people are naturally funny. You know, you can't be dumb and funny. You know what I mean? You can be smart and not funny, but you can't be dumb and funny.
I'm sure we could find somebody.
All right, I know you're thinking
there.
Of Larry the Cable Guy.
I immediately went to Larry. How did you know?
Did you really?
I really did.
Because that's where I go to.
Well, yeah, but you know, he wasn't always Larry the Cable Guy.
That's a character that he
And he's
that's
a college-educated guy.
It's a character he plays.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Red Neckerson, Red.
I really
come
did.
Get some.
I really did.
All right. Yeah. Anyway, that was a great conversation that I had with Mohsen, and we'll have that for you in just a little bit. But first, your breaking news. Whenever it feels like breaking, I have a long COVID, according to my doctors.
So. You broke this on like the last episode, by the way.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, old news.
Old news.
But I go in a little more detail for you guys because I know everybody out there is like, oh, Dave's got long COVID.
You should also say you have been vaccinated.
Yeah, vaccinated. I've had the boosted, all that. Two boosters, two vaccinations, everything. But I do have what my doctor calls long COVID. And he says it affects one out of every five people. And the way that it manifested in me was this. So it had been probably a good solid month where I've been waking up in the morning and my chest was very tight. I'd go around during the day. I'd felt like I couldn't get a full lungful of air. I would go for my daily runs and I couldn't get a mile or two out without having to stop and take walking breaks, which, you know, for me is completely out of sync with reality. So finally broke down and got a doctor's appointment and saw my doctor. And this guy is like, yeah, you got the long COVID. I'm going to give you an inhaler and then I'm going to set you up with some follow-up appointments. So I'm like, all right, great, whatever. And I walk out of there. And he wasn't my regular doctor, you know, he was just the first guy I could see. But I felt kind of awkward because it's just like, okay, and there was no paperwork at all. Usually you get the paperwork out of the doctor.
That tells you what you have.
Yeah, it tells you what the next steps are and not even the prescription. He was like, I'm going to write you this prescription, but he didn't tell me to go up and pick it up or anything. I had to go up and awkwardly stand in line and say, is there a prescription here for me?
And, I've been through that drill.
And they didn't explain. I've never had an inhaler. They didn't explain how to use it. But anyway, so I got the inhaler, and it works for, I take a couple puffs, take a couple hits off the inhaler before I go for a run or do exercise, and that does help. So then I'm like, all right, I don't know what to do here about these follow-up appointments. So I'm driving around. I'm heading home, and then all of a sudden I get a call from and it says, and usually I don't pick up the phone, but I knew it might be something.
Was this after your appointment at the urgent care?
Yes. No, it wasn't at urgent care. It was at Kaiser.
Okay.
The regular facility. So I get a call, and it says Kaiser on there. So
that's
I pick it up.
Turnaround.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very fast. It was later on that day. Hmm. It wasn't as I was driving home, but it was a couple hours later. So I pick up the call, and ironically enough, it seemed to be someone else who was having problems breathing because it was a real mouth breather. He sounded like a 16-year-old kid.
Oh.
And we'll just call him. He was very curt on the phone, so we'll call him Operator Kurt. And Operator Kurt starts demanding that I need to start calling these numbers to set up some appointments.
Huh.
I'm like, okay, great. And he's like, I'm going to give you the numbers. And I'm like, all right. And then there's a pause there, and he's like, you got something to write down? I'm like, hold on, I'm driving. Let me pull over, and I'll get the numbers.
Now, you didn't ask him, can you email me those? Can you message me those numbers?
The guy was, listen, I wanted to get this over with.
Great
I didn't want to, you know. I wanted to get these appointments set up so I could figure out what's going on.
I got a slight complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Our daughter had a seizure in March.
Yeah.
It took me months and months.
True.
To get her seen.
That's true.
I feel annoyed that a simple case of long COVID, no offense
hey,
to you.
Hey, how dare you? There's nothing simple about long COVID.
If he's saying it's one in five.
You got the wrong operators. You needed Operator Kurt. Hmm. Or you needed this doctor that I saw. By the way, the doctor that I saw, probably 40 pounds overweight, and told me how he would go, when I explained how I was a runner, he's like, yeah, I love to go watch my wife run. Sometimes I'll sit. The last marathon she did was through a winery in San Francisco, and I got to sit and drink wine and watch her run. I'm like, okay, doc. Okay, good for you.
There you go.
But yeah, he got he told Operator Kurt to give me the call, so I can't say anything bad about the guy.
No.
So Kurt rattles off these numbers. He doesn't tell me what they're for. He just tells me to call them. So I call the first number. And then I get Nurse Brusk. She asked me for my name and my Kaiser number. She, I gave them to her, and she says, okay, you need to call this other number first. So I'm like, all right, fine. Hang up with the nurse Brusque. Call it the second number. Now I call the second number. I get nurse, we'll call her nurse sympathetic. And she asked me, she's like, oh, how can I help you today? Now, I don't know what appointment I'm trying to set up. So I'm just like, I think I was given this number to call by a guy who doesn't know how to breathe. I'll call him Operator Kurt. I didn't say that. I said, I don't know. I think I need to set up an appointment. And immediately she says, oh, yeah, I see you need to set up a respiratory blah, 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 blah. Now, and then I'm thinking, well, if you knew that already, why are you asking me why I'm calling?
Because you could
be calling. You've got the information right there.
I'm telling you right now, in front of you. You could be calling for something else.
Why do you need to ask me
that? This is all they do. I've dealt with this for years with cancer.
It's so annoying.
I know.
Well, this woman, she says to me, and I wrote this down so I could get it just right. She says, I see you just saw the doctor today. And then she says, sorry to hear that. Are you all better?
Oh.
I'm like, what do you think? I just saw the doctor. I'm calling to schedule these appointments. Oh, no, I feel great. That's I just ran a second marathon.
Isn't that weird?
Today. How are you going to ask me, sorry to hear
they
that? Are you all better? Hey, that's her exact phrase.
Dave, can you calm down?
We don't
want you having an episode here on the air.
Yeah. I took a couple of hits off the inhaler before. No.
They shouldn't ask that.
No, they did. She should not.
What if the answer is really bad and she's not going to want to hear it and she'll feel bad about asking it?
I pretended like I didn't hear. I just went radio silence at that point. And then I could hear like clacking of the keys and she sets up the appointment for me.
And I don't want to make excuses, but we had a friend recently that worked at a doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
And she quit to go back to just being a lifeguard.
Oh,
but you know,
wow.
But unfortunately, because like they're paying like huge bonuses to go work as a lifeguard.
Really?
But you know,
I didn't know that.
It's you know, that's the problem. This is still the effects of COVID, and the fact that it's hard for anybody to find somebody that's somewhat qualified and willing to actually do the job.
Right. It's just like you don't ask someone if they feel all better when you're calling to set up a doctor's appointment. Complete incompetence.
You don't open that can of worms.
No.
So she sets it up, and finally, yesterday I had my first follow-up appointment, which is this respiratory appointment. I don't know what it was for. So I get into this woman's office, and it was hard to find, and there was like three-sentence instructions on how to get there, and there wasn't even a sign on the ceiling where everything else had a sign and where to wait. It said, wait next to the OBGYN thing. And so I feel like awkward sitting there by that. But finally, this woman comes out of the office and she's like, Dave? I'm like, yeah. She said, oh, great. Nobody can find this place. I'm like, oh. I found it. So she brings me in her office. Now, you know, it's Kaiser and it's a medical facility. Everybody's wearing masks. Mm-hmm. There, you have to put on a mask as soon as you get there. They have a stack of masks there. Mm. As soon as we get into her office, she rips hers off. She goes, I'm vaccinated. Go ahead and take yours off.
Does she know what you're there for?
I'm like, lady, I'm like, all right, whatever. Sure, fine. You know, I'll take mine off. And obviously, I'm thinking I have to anyway. So, you know,
you're going to have to
hear me breathe. But she took hers off right away.
Well, you know, I'm predisposed that anytime a woman tells me to take it off,
that's right.
It just comes off.
That's it.
Doesn't matter what they ask you to take off.
That's right.
Sir, leave your shirt, sir.
Luckily, all
your
I
have. Shirt stays on.
Please put the shirt back on. Well, she, so then she has me get into like a glass booth. If you've seen the movie Quiz Show, it's right out of the 21 Quiz Show.
Yeah.
It's like a glass
telephone booth.
Booth. And first the door was open, and later she...
Both references really outdated.
Telephone booth and a quiz show from the 60s. Yeah. How old are we? All right. Let's stay relevant. I'm glad we can relate to everybody out there listening. We're talking to book readers. I mean, the average age is not going to be kids in their teenage year. Well, you know, I do have students that listen to the show. Point is this. The point is, I had to get into this glass booth. She pinches. She gives me a thing that pinches my nose shut. Then she shoves this tube into my mouth. And then I had to do all kinds of breathing exercises. At one point, she slams the door shut. So now I am
in the cube.
And she's telling me to take four quick breaths. She's giving me the countdown. She's like, three breaths, two breaths, one more breath. Now four, quick, go, go, go. And when she said go, 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 I take four deep. And then I hear something click. And then the oxygen in the tube is cut off.
You are kidding me.
No, it's cut off. And I'm trying to breathe in and out four quick.
Gosh.
She's screaming through the glass, go, go, breathe, 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 breathe. And I can't get anything in or out of my mouth.
Who
I got a vacuum seal on this tube.
Oh, I started to panic.
And I'm like panicking. And she, oh, you did great. You did great. You did great. You did
She didn't tell you that was going to happen.
No, she didn't tell me that. She did not tell
At
me that was going to happen.
At any point, did they dispense cheese cubes to you?
No cheese cubes dispensed. No bell.
If you touched your nose to something, did a bell ring?
There was no bell.
No buzzer that hurt your little hand. I mean, paw.
No. But she was making notes in a little spiral bell notebook. But
I feel like they should have told you that.
No, because if she tells you that, then you start thinking about it, then you're not going to do
I feel less stressed
properly.
If I know what's going to happen.
But that one, I literally felt like I was drowning. It really scared
me. Oh, it's really scary, dude.
So how long, like, was how many seconds between, like, where you couldn't breathe?
Oh, and probably like 10 seconds.
Okay.
You know. But long enough, it was just 1 second would have been enough.
Anytime
you try to take a breath in, and there's not, it's not an experience you ever have unless you stick a
plastic bag
over your head. And then she showed me a bunch. She's like, oh, yeah, come on out of the glass booth. And then,
every Saturday night for Andrew.
That's right, exactly.
Where's my, thank you.
She shows me all these graphs, over explains it. I don't know what she's talking about. And then she does
graphs
on the computer of my breathing, what a normal person looks like a straight line. And what mine looked like was a beautiful curve. I'm like, oh, that curve looks beautiful. No, you want a straight line. I'm like, okay.
Wow.
And she's like, oh yeah, you have asthma and you'll have it for the rest of your life. I said, okay, great. Thank you. Where do I pay my bill?
Wow. Well, they'll find you.
That. Then she tells me about new, inhalers. So I'll be sucking on an inhaler every day for the rest of my life. I'll have several different options. Try this one. It's like trying on a new car. You can try this inhaler. You get it once in the morning, once in the evening. Or this one. You do it before exercise. You know, it's going to be great. I'll keep everybody posted on it.
I feel really sad for you. It sucks. Yeah, it does.
It does.
Wow. What's the next appointment?
I don't know. Oh, a scan of the lungs. That'll be Sunday.
To make sure
CT
it's not like
scan.
A thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, what about a chest x-ray? Oh, no. Those don't show you anything.
Really?
Yeah. We're going to learn everything you need to do today and Sunday.
Huh. Well, Dave, we'll be breathlessly waiting your update.
Okay. You don't know. No sound effect for that one. Laura, how has your week been?
Oh,
any
man.
Doctor's appointments for
yes.
you? Oh, no.
This
Come
is
on.
Like the, yeah, this huh. is the... Yeah.
How many can I'm sure everybody nowadays can relate.
I guess
everybody's
so.
Sick, getting sick.
So in February, I was putting on socks and I saw a very dark new freckle mm-hmm. on the sole of my foot.
Right.
And I am aware, I don't know why, I've always been aware, okay, there's a foot melanoma and it can kill you. Like young women in their 20s might see a dark spot in their freckle on their foot. They don't do anything about it.
How are you putting on your socks
years?
That you can see the bottom of your... Andrew, how do you put your socks on?
I don't even know.
I will sometimes look at the bottom of my feet because I used to have a freckle there that faded.
Oh, okay.
So and I'm aware... I'm, you know, I'm a nervous
so you're
Nelly.
Checking it
I'm
out.
A nervous Nelly.
Because I'm going to say, I just kicked my leg out and slipped the sock on. I'm not looking
I'm
at the
here
bottom
to tell
of my
everybody,
foot.
Just look at your feet.
Look at your feet.
Look at your feet.
Yes.
There's a melanoma out there that goes for the feet. Okay? And if you all of a sudden see a really dark freckle...
Yeah.
Now, let's also say is you are very, you know, fair complexion.
Mm-hmm.
I know if you describe your hair as red.
Yes. And I grew up in Florida, Andrew.
In Florida.
And, you know, and
on
so
a beach.
You have all the risk factors of somebody right. that has to be very careful with their skin.
Yes. So I saw it in February. In the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, that freckle could kill me.
Yeah, and February was quite a while ago.
I was in and out of remembering it, to be perfectly honest with you guys. And then I finally had a general, you know, you see your GP once a year.
Right.
Saw her and I was like, hey, I got this freckle on my foot. Mm. She looks at it. I can see the panic in her eyes.
No, that's not anything you want to see.
And she's like, I could take this off right here. She said, but I think you need to go see a dermatologist.
Mm.
She said, I want you to see a dermatologist right away. Right away.
Wow.
Urgency in her voice. She said, I'm sending them a note now. And you know, I've had trouble getting any calls back for problems that Sylvia's had.
Mm-hmm. So not for this.
Literally, she scared me enough, like, okay, doc, I'm going to go get this taken care of. And I'm stepping out. The door has not closed behind me from her office. Kaiser, so I got you beat.
Wow,
you did beat me.
Was it Operator Kurt? Was it a 16-year-old kid out of breath? No, it was a
really sweet woman. Oh. Sweet, sweet woman.
Sweet as
Who's
Georgia
like,
pie.
Hey, I hear you've got a freckle that needs to be looked at. Wow. We're ready. And so they booked me. I had my dermatologist trip. And then, so Andrew, in between, Dave, I'm telling you because Dave knows.
Yeah.
In between that visit with my GP and the dermatologist visit, I have been racked with worry.
Right.
I have been Googling statistics of survival rates.
Nonstop Googling.
Melanoma. Hey,
Andrew, ask me how many times I Googled asthma or long COVID. Ask me.
Did you not Google that?
No, I didn't Google it.
I Googled it for you, so there you go.
You did Google it
I've
for
Googled
me,
it yeah. multiple times for you.
Yeah, I have not Googled it once. Not once. Not
so,
once.
So the night before the procedure, which was Monday night, so Sunday night, I had trouble sleeping. You know, I should have gotten it in February, even though if it's stage one, stage two, it's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, odds are it's fine. Then I go into the office. Dermatologist is really nice. She's like, oh, yeah, let's get this off. Ooh. And then she looks at where it is, and it's on the center of the bottom of my foot, so the sole of my foot. And she goes, I'm not going to lie to you. This is going to hurt. And then the nurse kind of chuckles.
Oh, no, really?
And then she picks up a long needle to numb it. And it was the needle. And it hurt so bad that I gave a cry out.
Oh.
And then she immediately did a, how old's your daughter? And I was like, I'm trying
to
remember.
They're supposed to like, take your mind off of it before they stick the needle
in. I know.
Now, did they use the cold stuff before they gave you the needle?
No.
Yeah,
no numbing solution on the skin?
No, before? It was a lidocaine, a needle filled with lidocaine.
Mm.
And the doc scraped the thing off, slapped a bandage on.
Yeah, I do
on.
Have some sound effects of the doc scraping it. did it sound something like that?
Oh, God. I was so traumatized by the lidocaine.
Ma'am, please hold still. Ma'am, I can't. You need to hold your foot still.
So I've had a few things removed at a dermatologist.
I have
right?
too. It's not my first
Andrew,
one.
And remember, Andrew famously
Oh, he did.
Tried
he tried to remove his own.
Yeah, I did. I did. That did not turn out well. That did not
turn
out well.
Cut into a major artery.
Oh, man.
I can freeze this all, but I don't need no doctor to do it.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah,
Andrew, you do know a little bit about that.
Yeah. Emphasis on the word.
But little. I also had the dermatologist cut a few things off, freeze things off.
I've had the freezing,
and,
yeah.
And it's amazing how skilled they are
at
basically cutting things off.
It really is.
Yeah, there's no reason, I mean, really to be afraid of them just generally removing stuff.
You wonder what they were doing as kids. You think they were cutting into their Barbie dolls?
I don't know. My general practitioner, she's like, I could hack away at it. She's like, but I think that if we can get you into a dermatologist, she's like, they'd just scoop that right out.
Yeah. And
so,
she did.
Yeah, and so anyway, the doc left. She did pop the door open at one point to say, which foot was that? Was that your right foot or your left foot?
Was she joking?
No. And I said, it was my right foot. And then I made an amputation joke with the nurse who enjoyed that.
That's good.
And then I also told the nurse, I was like, that hurt so bad.
Yeah.
And she's like, that lidocaine hurts like a son of a bitch when it goes in. And I should find out, you know, if it's melanoma or not. And I'm really hoping it's not, because I think if it is, then they have to get back
go
in.
Deeper.
And scrape more. Boy. But it's on the stupid bottom of my foot. Dave, you got to stop playing that. You got to stop playing that. And it hurts. Like, the bottom of my foot hurts.
Yeah.
And
The worst
know.
Needle I ever had was one right to the roof of the mouth.
Oh.
That's straight into the roof of the mouth. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's bad.
I'm not even going to tell you where the worst needle I've had was. So we won't go there.
No.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
True. Anyway, Andrew, how have you been?
So, you know, like I tell everybody's like, hey, Andrew, how are you? I'm like, living the dream. I'm living the dream.
That's what you do love to say.
But because basically, I don't know. I just don't really want to. And it's just.
It's a tough time for you right now.
Busy. Well,
Andrew's
I
been
love
busy
my,
for 52 years.
Yeah, yeah. I love That's my family. True, yes. I love my kids. You know, I work. I can't really say that I necessarily love my work. I enjoy my work
sometimes,
um, But you know, it's they wouldn't hire somebody like me. Nobody hires anybody like me unless they have a tough job to do. Right? Right? It's just the way it is. I mean, technology is not easy.
Yeah, it's right? not.
Yep. And so, mm-hmm. you know, and I tried to get out of technology for a while, and I succeeded for a decade. But, you know, it's just like the Godfather. They keep pulling me back in. So, but, so Tuesday morning, it's my son's 11th birthday.
Yes. Happy birthday to Peter.
To Peter.
6:30 in the morning. I'm out the door, headed to work. Hmm. Right? you know, I'm driving in my car, and I'm not somebody that is like a super fast or aggressive driver. You know, I'm listening to the radio. I'm enjoying myself. I've got my coffee made. I'm enjoying my coffee on the ride in. So I want to get in. I'm not dragging my feet, mm-hmm. but I'm enjoying the journey, right? If there's anything to say about Andrew Dowdy, he's enjoying the journey.
I don't think that's what they say.
I don't know
about
if that's something that people say.
So
but I think it's the opposite of what they say, but carry on.
Yeah. Carry on.
Yeah. So you know, so I make the transition, I get you know, from the highway. Mm-hmm. To the road, which basically heads into downtown Denver.
Yeah, Auraria Parkway.
Right? Now, as soon as I make that turn, there's a you know, the huge ramp is just a huge hill down into the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is probably one of the sharpest, like, drop-offs into the city itself. I mean, this, you know, if this was a sledding hill, you'd be going, like, 30 miles an hour down this hill. So, and anyways, when you make that turn, as soon as you make that turn, and then it's just straight... Mm-hmm. The sun is just staring me right in the eyes.
Oh yeah, because I have to go that same direction in the mornings to work. Yes, terrible glare.
Right?
Terrible glare. You're heading due east.
Right, and so I'm like, you come right off the highway and it's right there. So then, what do I see? I look over to my right, and I could just barely see because they are between me and the sun. And there is Ponch and John. Colorado Highway Patrol.
Colorado's finest.
Right? And these guys... They are looking cool as a cucumber.
Sure, on their motorcycles,
their sunglasses. I mean, you know, we're talking. They might not be dressed like Ponch and John from back.
Sure,
in, you know,
another
the
nice,
days.
Another lovely dated reference.
It is dated. I remember them so well, though.
But it is Colorado's modern version.
Yeah,
and of course the guy, nobody. I mean, they must teach this, which is the aggressive point.
You can see their eyes get big behind the sunglasses.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's the police officer point, like, I'm pulling you over.
I've gotten the point. Wow. There's nothing, your stomach's safe.
And I'm sitting there thinking, shouldn't you have both hands on that motorcycle? You know,
is it Ponch or John? Was it Eric Estrada or the other guys?
I don't know. So anyways, so clearly I'm pulling over. So I pull over on a side street.
Were they pulling multiple people
they
over?
They were. They pulled another guy over, too. And
shooting
I just followed,
fish in a barrel.
I just followed that other guy coming over. And he's like, do you know how fast you're going? And I said, 40? And he's like, well, you're doing 43. And it's within the realm of possibility that was going 43.
43 doesn't seem that bad to me.
But when I looked at the speedometer, especially not exiting a highway where people are going 60, 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
In a downhill ramp.
Yeah, it doesn't seem that bad.
But basically, you know, that's what he said, right? And I didn't argue with the guy.
Yeah, you can't.
Well,
you shouldn't. You can.
Well, that's true. Yeah, because you can.
And I'll tell you, and here's what's going through my mind. Well, I'll get back to that. But anyways, so he ends up giving me a warning, right?
That's great, Andrew.
You know, and I told him, I said, you know.
What was the speed limit there?
So the speed limit was 30.
Oh. But. And over 10.
And I will get to that.
Yeah, but you're going over 10, they're going to pull
Well,
you over.
And he says that this would have been a 4-point ticket. Right?
Wow.
Now, the thing is, because what happens is the speed limit goes from 40 to 30 right there. And they literally are within a half a dozen yards of where the speed limit sign is. Now, I went back and looked today.
You did a little research.
Well, because I want to, I want to see. I'm not trying to basically speed that much. You know, and if this guy had probably waited another block, I would have been slowed down to 30 miles an hour, right? It's just the transition. But you can't even see the speed limit sign because there's a tree completely blocking the damn sign. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't see it anyway. And I will tell you, if you go to court and you basically can prove that the speed limit, the change in speed was not posted, or you could even show that the speed limit sign was obstructed, you can get out of a ticket. And that's why I also wasn't going to argue with him, because it's basically like, if it's really a 4-point ticket, we're going to court.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I'm going to go back and look, because I went to court one time, very similar situation, another effing speed trap. And I went, and then the girl behind me went, who got a speeding ticket at the same point.
Oh.
And she basically said the speed limit wasn't posted.
Wow.
No ticket.
Wow, really?
I had a similar thing with a school zone where there was no school on the road I'm driving on, but it was a school zone. But yeah. It was on the street over. And so, but I got a visual, a camera click. And I was literally doing 5 miles over the speed limit. But it was a school zone. But just like you said, Andrew, I couldn't see the sign because there was a tree over it. Because I went back the next day and I was like, I didn't see that school zone sign.
Yeah. Especially in the summertime, you know, these trees grow. They can't trim everything back.
So the other odd thing is that in the last 4 years, I have been pulled over 3 out of the 4 years on August 2nd because it's my son's birthday.
That's weird. And so you remember that?
Oh, I remember because my son is always like, dad got a ticket on my birthday.
Right.
Like,
what a strange thing. I remember this.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
And then the 1 year I didn't get one, it's because I was in Hawaii on vacation. you know, so anyways.
Yeah, stay off the roads.
August 2nd next year. Please remind me.
Yeah.
Please remind me. But, you know, as a result of this ticket, I am a little bit more aware of the speed situation there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And I really don't feel like I was driving unsafe. I just think if they had the speed changed earlier, and
it's
that's just
trap.
It. Yeah.
It's a trap. It's a trap. That's what it was.
So
it plain and simple, it was a moneymaker.
Mm-hmm. So we've all...
And it wasn't even the end of the month. It was the beginning of the month.
And that's it. It's the beginning of the month. But there have been a lot of pedestrian fatalities in Denver.
Mm.
And I wonder if they're really trying to... They're really cracked down on that because, you know, there's a lot of places
scary.
Pedestrians and stuff are...
That downtown area where you work, Andrew... I don't know how people don't get hit on those stupid scooters.
What they need to do is get these scooters off the road. These drunk kids riding around on these scooters on and off the
sidewalk.
Two and
three kids
into
on a
traffic.
Bike.
It's ridiculous.
They need a little steel post.
Back
like
in my day, we didn't have our scooters were foot powered.
Well, one of the most dangerous scooter behaviors that I saw recently was a full grown adult male. Basically, he had his 2 or 3 year old kid. This guy's not wearing a helmet. He's on a scooter. He's got his 2 or 3 year old hanging with his arms around his neck.
Nope.
And he's and he's going like 10 miles an hour.
Nope.
You know, and like if that little kid let go,
yeah.
Oh my god.
I mean, we're talking. He's 2 or 3 years old.
Was he on the road?
Yeah, driving. Not on a like. He was in a community.
Oh, in the community.
Driving, and I'm just sitting there looking at this, and I couldn't even watch it.
No, there's stuff like that you cannot look at.
I couldn't watch it. It's just like, what's going through somebody's head?
I don't know.
You know, that they're going to let their 2 or 3 year old, and when I say 2 or 3, it could be he was less than 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was a small little baby, you know, really young child, a toddler, you know, so even 3 might have been pushing it. And I'm just sitting there just looking at this. But like I said, I had to look away. I could not stand to watch. And it's not like I could also go over there and tell the guy who's probably been drinking with a whole bunch of other people that have been drinking that, hey, you know, that might not be a good idea.
Yep. Wow.
All right. Well, listen, I'll tell you what is a good idea.
We were
talking
downer.
To Mohsen Hamid.
Yeah,
that's a great idea.
Let's bring it up.
His new book is called The Last White Man. So this is the Kafka-esque tale about a white man who wakes up the next morning only to find out, quote, he had turned a deep and undeniable brown. Soon, everyone starts turning brown. This is an ingenious book that asks us to think about the ways in which we relate to people, particularly based upon what we look like. I absolutely love this one. And you'll hear Mohsen talk much more eloquently and deeply about his book than I can. So let's get into it right now. Talking about his book, The Last White Man, this is the really, really smart Mohsen Hamid. This is why we can't have nice things, darling. Because you break them, I have to take them away. This is why we can't have nice things, darling. Did you think I wouldn't hear all the things you said about me? Well, adapter stopped working for some reason.
Oh no!
It's always something. Why can't things just flow naturally? But I guess that doesn't happen.
I have like three different Wi-Fis, and somehow, and somehow I can't tell you how many times all three aren't working at the same. You know, my kids are streaming like TikTok, you know, seamlessly, and then I have to get onto a call, and suddenly none of them are working. It's crazy.
That's hilarious. My daughter does the same thing. It's like, what is the fascination with this TikTok? The scrolling through these endless, mindless, and you actually touch on a little bit of the social media in your book. But it's like, what, you're not benefiting yourself at all by this mindless scrolling. Please stop.
That's right. Yeah. No. Absolutely.
Where am I talking to you from today?
I'm in New York City.
Ah, New York City. Very nice.
Yeah, where are you?
Colorado, Littleton, Colorado.
Okay.
Yes, I ran the...
In New York, everybody says, oh, well, you know, New York's had such a tough time and New York is over. And you see every young person you meet is looking for an apartment and sort of desperate to find a place to live. And so I think forecasts of New York's demise have been maybe a little bit overwritten.
A little premature. Yeah. Are you in Manhattan?
I'm up near Columbia. So look at you.
Very nice. We lived in Brooklyn in Park Slope for about I taught in Manhattan before we moved out here. But yeah.
Well, Park Slope is wonderful.
It is. Right by Prospect Park. Great place to run.
You're certainly much better positioned for climate change where you are now.
that's right.
There needs to be a lot of sea level rise to.
No, you want to be a mile high. That's where we are.
A good glacial water supply.
So. That's right. Listen, Mohsen, I can't tell you how much I loved your book. Speaking of things that are going to make you think, well, we weren't, but this is a book. This book, really, I got to take you to task. You made me think here, and the book resonated with me, and I appreciate that. The Last White Man, a fabulistic love story about race, graveyards, and gyms. Mohsen, what was it that inspired you to write this book?
You know, in first 30 years until 2001, I'd lived about 18 years in the U.S. and 12 in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And I was living in New York in 2001, and I'd been to these sort of elite universities, had a well-paying job. And, you know, my experiences of discrimination were pretty minor. I'm a brown-skinned guy with a Muslim-sounding name. But I would say that, you know, my life had been fairly easy in the U.S. I wouldn't say that, you know, the difficulties of the world had particularly fallen on my shoulders.
Right.
And then, you know, after 9/11, something funny happened. You know, suddenly... I got stopped at airports and pulled out for extra checks, and I would fly into JFK, and the immigration guys would send me to a separate room where I'd wait for 4 or 5 hours to be, you know, interrogated. Or I'd show up on a bus, you know, with a backpack, and people would sort of, you know, unshaven, and people would look a little bit uncomfortable.
Right.
And I kept sort of wanting things to go back to the way they were. You know, I wanted to be, you know, breezing through JFK and sort of arriving for the flight the last minute, and people not to think that I was somebody threatening or suspicious. And I felt like I'd lost something. Mm. And as I thought about, you know, what have I lost? I thought, you know, I guess what I've lost is in a sense a kind of, you know, a kind of partial whiteness, in the sense that the ability to pass as unremarkable, mm-hmm. just as everybody else, nothing more or less. And I think that I started to think, you know, what was that thing, and what did it mean? To have it, and if I could lose it, what about people who had already lost it? And so those notions, I guess, gestated for about 20 years, and then found their way into this book about this guy Anders, who wakes up one morning, and he's dark, and the night before when he went to bed, he was white, and he has to deal with this.
Yeah. And his initial reaction is, of course, one of anger, which I thought was interesting. It kind of taps into like the zeitgeist right now. You see a lot of angry white people out there. I don't know how popular your book is going to be with the Trump crowd. I don't know if you've run it, if you've gone to any rallies and tried to sell books.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. The title might be less popular than the book if people actually actually read it.
Good point.
Because in a way, the book is called The Last White Man, mm-hmm. but it's really about. The loss of a kind of racial identity.
Yes.
It's not about the eradication of a particular kind of person. It's about entering into a world where we can't identify each other as belonging to a particular race. Mm-hmm. And so it's less, I guess, extinguishing something and more opening something up. But yeah, I could understand how that title or the basic premise would freak some people out.
It's a beautiful book. And, you know, as a teacher myself and as someone who spent 20 years educating or teaching kids of color, and we had a year-long professional development on anti-racism. I learned more from your book. I felt more from your book than I did from reading all the scholarly articles and studies during that year. I don't know if it's just I learned more from fiction or it's just how well you spoke to what you described. You did through the characters in just such an elegant yet visceral way. Do you agree? Do you find that you yourself also respond to fiction better than nonfiction sometimes?
I mean, you know, I think they do different things oftentimes. So, you know, nonfiction often is, you know, telling you what the writer thinks the situation is.
Right.
And when I write nonfiction, I'm saying, you know, here's what I think. Fiction is something a little bit different. Fiction is being an 8-year-old again and saying, all right, finding a buddy and saying, you know, let's pretend we're pirates or astronauts.
Right.
And, you know, and this tree becomes the mast of the ship and those leaves become the fins of sharks. And we're going to play this game together. And it's funny because when you're playing that game and you're 8 years old, you are a pirate. It's not like, you know, you're this kid who's sort of, you know, engaging in a play, right? You know, you guys are really believing it. And I think fiction is like that because so much of how we think is we have an emotional response to things. Mm-hmm. And then we use reason to justify our emotional response. So when you come at somebody with a reasonable, rational argument, unless you shift that emotional response, you may not achieve very much. You know, just like two lawyers arguing different sides of a case. But in fiction, people get to try on different points of view. They get to sort of slip into reading a book, imagining it for themselves, seeing how that makes them feel, and then kind of in solitude, figuring out if their emotions have changed a little bit. And I think that's really important because, you know, one of the things the book tries to do is it tries to actually honor the sense of loss that these characters have as their whiteness disappears. Mm-hmm. That, you know, whether one thinks of whiteness as a good thing or a bad thing, I think it's possible to say, look, the feeling of loss that people have, of their group disappearing, of their way of life disappearing, of things changing, is something that's quite profound. Mm-hmm. and should be dealt with in a way with dignity. And so the book tries to give that dignity to the characters.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. You know, I kept thinking of my students who would tell me endlessly stories of them walking into a store in the mall and get followed around, or even in their own community. Just they would just be walking down the street and, you know, feel a cop behind them. And it's just something like you were describing. We wish it to go away, but you know, it's always there and pervades ceaselessly.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that it feels to us like it's always there. Mm-hmm. But you know, a few hundred years ago, it wasn't there.
Right.
So, and a few hundred years from now, it won't be again. So the ancient Greeks didn't think of race the way that, you know, 21st century Americans think of race. And when Columbus set out to come to the Americas, you know, 500 years ago, 400 and some years ago, you know, Spain had just completed the reconquest by Christians from the Muslims who had ruled Spain for many centuries. And when that reconquest was completed, the real question was, were you a Muslim or a Jew, or were you a Catholic? If you were a Muslim or a Jew, you should probably leave. And if you were a Catholic, you could stay. But nobody cared if your heritage was Muslim or Jewish, if you were brown or if you had lighter skin. The question is what you believed in. So at various points in history, it's the language you speak, the religion you have. It's not the quote-unquote race you belong to that people think of as important. So we look at, you know, the way things are in America today. We imagine that it's always been like this. It'll always be like this. But actually, it's just a passing historical period. And, you know, a couple hundred years from now, people will be thinking about things very differently.
Hmm. I hope so. And your book is ultimately hopeful. If that's, you know, if that's a spoiler, we can cut that out. But I feel, you know, I don't think that's saying too much to say that it's a hopeful book. Listen, let's talk about your opening line to your book. What a great Kafka-esque opening to this book. One morning, Anders, a white man, woke up to find he had turned a deep and undeniable brown. Now, you got to know, when you write a book like this, you're going to have that first line. And you write a line like that, it's going to be quoted back to you endlessly. Did you work really hard on this one, or did it just pop into your head one day?
I mean, that line is sort of where the book began.
Yeah.
So I had the idea of this title and this opening. Okay. And it, you know, it took maybe 15 years to come up with the idea of the title and the opening. But once I had that, and I knew I wanted to write this book about race and about, in a sense, the destabilizing of race, I sort of went with that. But definitely, I've always admired sort of the mid-20th century, you know, modernist writers like Kafka and Virginia Woolf and Camus and Calvino and Jorge Luis Borges. Oh, yes. And they were doing interesting things back then because their time 100 years ago was a lot like our time. There were wars. There was a rise of xenophobia and sort of racial and ethnic hatred. There was huge technological change. And a lot of these writers played with form and they bent reality. And they did certain moves that I think are still very useful for writers today to explore because their times and our times are starting to look very similar once again.
And your book, yeah, would fit so nicely and comfortably on the shelf next to those masters that you just mentioned. You know what I kept thinking about during this book? I don't know if you ever saw the old Eddie Murphy sketch from Saturday Night Live where he like has makeup put on to make him look like a white guy, and then he goes into an urban environment to see what it's like when there's only white people around. You ever see that sketch?
I don't remember if I did, but yeah, it sounds familiar.
Yeah, and then so he gets he goes into the store to buy a newspaper, and there's a white guy behind the counter, and he gives him the money. And the white guy's like, "What are you doing? Why are you paying for this newspaper?"
I remember now. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Yeah, good stuff. It's called a white. I had to go back and watch that sketch after you read it because it really just got me thinking about race and these ideas.
Yeah, I mean it's that was hilarious, and I think there's also even in Beverly Hills Cop, there's this moment where there's a Eddie Murphy's character is this cop. And there's this other cop who's a black cop from Beverly Hills. And Eddie Murphy basically is teasing this other cop all the time and sort of accusing him of sounding white or sounding sort of Beverly Hills. And I think, this this playful space around race, like, what are we? What do we belong to? And why are we forced to pretend that we, have to be this way? That I have to be this sort of Pakistani guy or this white guy or this Muslim guy. Why aren't we more free to sort of move around and kind of try on different things? It's something that's been in the culture, I think, forever, really.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Now, to me, a lot of this book is about, perception. And it's interesting to me how Anders, when he finds himself dark, he meets the eyes of people who are, quote, look like him. And then when he catches their eye, he will look away, like not realizing these are just simply shared glances, something we all do every day in life. Was this something you thought about and wanted to make sure that you included?
Yeah, well, I think, there's Anders is in this period of flux. He wants people to see him as he used to be. And he's not sure if they're not seeing him that way because he doesn't look like that or if he's acting differently, if there's something about him. And so he starts to become, paranoid, and he starts to become self-conscious, and he starts to become different. And so, and he starts to discover that it's actually not just skin deep, that he, he hasn't become a new race, but he can't act like the way he did before. Mm-hmm. He's unable to play that role. And so even though he's exactly the same person, he's also not the same person. When he tries to act like the old Anders in the gym where he works, he realizes that it's really kind of uncomfortable to be acting like himself. And it seems awkward to people. And I think, anytime any of us have wandered into a situation where nobody knows us and we're the new kid, an elementary school, perhaps, there's that time when you sort of come in and people sort of ignore you, except when they don't ignore you in a pretty hostile way all of a sudden. And you're never quite sure how to act in that, for that first hour or first few hours. Right. And that's what Anders has to go through.
Yeah. Occasionally, we'll get like a new student in our class where I teach, and they'll go by a different name. I'll find out later that they will have come to the school. They've given themselves a different name, and we see that a lot with kids now. Also today, giving themselves different names, trying to assume different personalities, different identities, and that's something you play with here, which is really just fascinating to think about how someone can do it. But it always seems to me they revert back. They always revert back to, you know, who they were before. And still, no matter how much they try to become someone different or act a different way, they always go back to, you know, who they are in their essence.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing, right? Which is that, you know, if you're just trying something on, oftentimes you try it on and you put it aside. Mm-hmm. But sometimes something happens, right? You try something on and it sticks. You do an internship at a job and you find that this is what I want to do with my life. Mm-hmm. Or you travel to a country and you never move back. Or you leave New York City for, you know, the mountains of the Rockies and you're like,
right.
You know what? I'm staying.
That's right.
So I think, you know, 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, what you said is that we try things on and then we go back is true. But there's always that 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 times when we try something on and it just fits. And that's why I think it's important to allow people to experiment allow them to explore different things. Because yeah, most of the time it's just, you know, it's just play acting. But every so often we discover something about ourselves.
That's a great point. I love that. So Anders, you mentioned he works in a gym in this book, which is also a place where you might say we go to alter our appearance as well. Do you spend a lot of time in gyms? Do you go to the gym for research purposes?
You know, I mean, I, to be honest, I don't spend a lot of time in gyms. I have what I need at home. Particularly during the pandemic, things got very basic for me where it was, yeah. You know, I had, you know, a set of free weights, and so I would sort of, you know, sit down and I would do my deadlifts, and I would do I do a floor press instead of a bench press.
Oh,
and,
you know,
I just sort of, you know, you realize that with a barbell and some plates and a floor, you can, and if you have a pull up bar, you're pretty much good to go.
That's true.
So you know, I'm 51 now, and I actually really enjoyed the minimalism of it. And when I was writing the book, I was, you know, really into it. And I think that, you know, for me, what's also interesting is partly, of course, we go to the gym to alter our appearance, but partly we go to engage in sort of a basic physical labor. I think so many of us don't have jobs which involve physical labor.
Right.
And, you know, we do things with our minds, and we do things with our fingers, but not with our backs. And I think there's a craving that so many of us have, you know, to be physical beings again. And so in Anders' case, it's interesting. He has a job that involves labor, but it's sort of optional labor. and in a way, it's a sign of devalued labor that, you know, in a country where once upon a time, you know, most men, because it was mostly men, would go to workplaces that involved, you know, very strenuous physical labor. And most women, for that matter, would also do very strenuous physical labor, whether it's in farms or in houses. And that labor meant something, and it gave you something to bring back home and feed your family, etc. That's kind of vanished. And so in Anders's gym is this sort of spiritual place, in a way, where people are going to re-experience that physical sense of what makes them, you know, a man or makes them a human being. But nobody's getting paid for it anymore. And they're doing it really just out of a desire, without the paycheck.
Mm, fascinating. Yeah. You never hear, you know, you really put in a hard day's work, you know what I mean? It's
right.
Come to mean something different now.
No, it's right. I mean, you know, I think it's so interesting. Also, I guess, you know, when you look at talking about gyms, the fundamental part of human work, if anyone's ever done any kind of, you know, physical labor, recognizes that it's sort of your back really which is doing the work. You know, it's sort of the lower back and maybe your hips that are doing most of the work anytime we do anything heavy. But so little, it seems, of what people think about gyms has to do with those things. You know, so much of the gym is whatever, your biceps or your
right.
something else.
Yeah, the chest.
Yeah, but I guess the gym that Anders goes to is also a spiritual place. It's a place where these men, because they're mostly men, are trying to lift something off themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle. And Anders found it deeply satisfying. And suddenly, he just doesn't fit in. Mm.
Yeah, I love how everyone, you know, what happened during the pandemic is everyone thought they were going to turn themselves into Lance Armstrong. So you couldn't, you know, find a bike anywhere. And then now, you know, you got bikes lying everywhere. And maybe, like you were talking about before, maybe it stuck with one or two of them, but I doubt it. I doubt it.
Yeah. Well, I think we could all use a bit more biking in our lives. That's for sure. Yeah.
I like to run. I say my gym, you know, is right out here. You hit the trails and that's the most beautiful gym in the world. Although we have been, you know, the older you get, you find, and we did just get a gym membership because you gotta do some weight training. You gotta do some strength training as well.
Well, you know, Haruki Murakami says that, that you have to strengthen the body to write books. And he runs these marathons and he's this crazy, incredible fitness regimen. You know, he swims, he bikes, he's a triathlete, marathon runner. And he writes these huge, huge books. You know, I write these little tiny, you know, less than 200 page things. So, you know, a couple sets of deadlifts and maybe an hour of walking a day is about as much strength as I need.
That's great. And you don't have to be very strong to lift your books, you know, also. So
that's right.
That's great. All right, Mosen, it's time now for our segment we call Quick Six. These are six quick questions in which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. What is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
The last show, well, I guess what I'm watching right now is For All Mankind. The science fiction epic on Apple Plus. I wouldn't say it's my favorite show of all time, but it's certainly the one that I'm watching this summer with my wife.
Nice. All right. I haven't heard of that one. I have to check that one. What is your favorite show of all time?
You know, I was pretty hooked on Game of Thrones there for a while. Oh, yeah. I think of modern day comedies. I really loved Aziz Ansari's Master of
None. Oh, yes. So good. So good.
And Silicon Valley was pretty damn funny.
Yeah,
And there's been some amazing limited series that you know, I've seen recently. But I guess when I was a kid, the show that, you know, I used to, when I moved from Pakistan to California at age 9, they would show one American TV show once a week at like 9 p.m. on Wednesday. And it would be a different film, you know, different show every year. And, you know, Trapper John, M.D. or whatever it was. And then one year it was Battlestar Galactica.
Oh.
And my whole week was planning so that I could be home at 9 o'clock to watch this one show that reminded me of like California in the 70s. And so, yeah, I love that show.
That's great. Awesome. How about this? Give me a, or I'm sorry, what fictional world or place would you like to visit?
Who?
Westeros?
No, I think the problem is too many of the fictional places that I know are places that I'd like to see from a very, very safe.
Well, we'll let you back in. We'll let you back in if you just like to pop by for a quick.
So if I could visit and not get hurt, you know, I would have really liked to have gone to two of the books I loved as a kid were. Frank Herbert's Dune and you know, Tolkien's Middle Earth, and so yeah, either of those would be great.
All right, very good. How about this? Give me a top five favorite movie of yours.
Ooh, I mean, one of the funniest movies I think I've ever seen is A Fish Called Wanda.
Oh, what! How great! I've seen that movie 1,000 times. Never gets
people
old.
Today have never heard of it, but it was this. It was this, you know, 1980s classic. Yes. It's about as funny as things get.
Yeah, I remember it came out. I think the same summer as Die Hard, and I had a choice to see Die Hard or Fish Called Wanda. I went and see Fish Called Wanda. My friends were like, "Why? Why would you want to go see Die Hard? No, this is hilarious! You gotta."
It was really
John fun. Cleese, Jamie Lee, Kevin Kline. I think won an Oscar for that role.
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah. How about this? A top five favorite book of yours?
You know, these days I've been thinking a lot about James Baldwin and in particular Another Country. And anybody who hasn't read the first 100 pages of Another Country probably hasn't read the best 100 pages of fictional prose that, in the English language. I remember reading that. I was living in New York. I just moved to New York City about a quarter century ago. And it's set in New York City. And the opening 100 pages, you know, this character sort of walking around town. I remember just sitting down to read that and thinking, wow, okay, you can write like this. So yeah, high recommendation.
That's awesome. Sometimes people will read something like that and it will get them away from writing altogether. Like, I'll never be able to, you know, to attain the heights that I've just read, but some people get inspired by it.
I think that at least for me, the risk isn't that I'm going to start, you know, stop writing. The risk is that I'm going to start trying to copy the person too blatantly.
Yeah. That's a good point. All right, Mohsen, how about this? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Ooh. I do not have a go-to karaoke song, but if I were to have a go-to karaoke song, let me think. Oh wow, that's a difficult one.
Yeah, it's a deep one. This is a deep thinking question.
You know, I mean, I at this moment, as you speak, sort of somehow the voice of Don Henley is coming into my, brain, and you know, I'm thinking of like some weird, you know, Boys of Summer, or maybe Hotel California would be one, but I think it might date me too much. I wish I could come up with some Taylor Swift song. My daughter listens to that kind of stuff, and I probably could sing it better than Hotel California.
You need to do a deep dive. 1989 is the name of her best album, I think.
I think I could do probably a pretty decent Taylor Swift karaoke.
There you go. Also good in concert, so I would highly recommend seeing her in concert. But you got to have a teenage daughter to take with you, you know what I mean? You can't just show up... middle-aged guy.
You know, unfortunately, you have to have a teenage daughter willing to go with you. I have one I can take, but I just somehow think I'm going to turn and look to my side if you won't be there.
And finally, Mohsen, what book are you currently reading?
Oh, so I... well, I guess the book that I'm reading over several years and keep coming back to and dipping into is Herodotus's Histories. And it's a crazy book because it's huge. and he sort of talks about everywhere. You know, he's in Egypt, he's sort of in Arabia, he's ancient Greek, writing about the world. And it's crazy stuff. I mean, you know, I don't know how much of it was actually true. But the way people are living, it's like this wild ride through what humanity looks like. So you know, there's this place where marriages have to reform after a certain amount of time, or where the rivers flow backwards, and you read this stuff, and some of it you're thinking, you know, this feels like obviously like, you know, some sort of magical fantasy realm. Uh-huh. Other things you read and you think like, this is some futuristic societal, like, you know, a polyamorous like space camp. it's a real head twist, and also he talks about, you know, how societies are governed and what they're made of, and you read stuff like that and you think, you know, in over 2,000 years, we might not have changed very much, really, at all.
Fascinating. I have not read that book. I will check that out, though. That sounds
it's worth a skim. I mean, I think I would dip in and out.
Okay.
Don't make the mistake of trying to go from beginning to end the way I have. I think it'll take me longer to read the histories than it took him to write it. Yeah.
It's good to have a book like that you can dip in and out of, though, every once in a while.
I think so. It's a nice touchstone.
All right, Mohsen, listen, I loved your book. Again, The Last White Man. Love your background, too. Those are great floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, it looks like. Really nice.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is actually awesome. This is actually the study of Mira Nair, the woman who directed the film of The Reluctant Fundamentalist, who's a dear friend. And so
that's awesome.
I'm doing this from her study.
All right, very good. Well, I'll go and mingle and have a great day there in Manhattan, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye bye.
All right. Bye.
The Inside Flap. All right, there you go. I told you the guy was smart. The guy is really, really smart and funny and interesting and just a great guy. Check out his book, The Last White Man. All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Where we are, I don't know where we are.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called Honor by 3D Umrigar.
All right, Honor.
Yeah, and so this is realistic women's fiction. It's the type of book I seldom read.
That's true. You don't read a lot of women's fiction.
These types of stories can be upsetting.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, sometimes I'm just upset enough. I don't need to be upset anymore. This story is just a page-turner, though. I started it, and I thought, well, it gets great reviews. I'll see how far I get was my philosophy when I started it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing I know, I couldn't put it down. Put it down.
Wow.
This is such a page turner. The writing is very clear. It's simple. It's deep. It's riveting. I couldn't put the book down once I started it. And I was astonished at myself the whole time because I don't read books like this because I do. If they're, they can be upsetting. Especially this is women's issues. And, you know, it's the world is, you know, painful enough for women.
Sure.
You know, all the time. Mm-hmm. So this is the story of a younger Indian-American journalist named Smita. Her friend, another journalist, has been involved in a really terrible car crash in India. She's covering a story, and she needs help finishing this story. Smita comes in to help. She arrives in from America very reluctantly. So Smita and her family left India when she was a teenager, and she has unresolved, very complicated feelings towards her native country. So some parts of India she loves, some parts she absolutely hates. We're not sure why when we start this, why she and her family fled. Mm. They fled India, but that will come out throughout the book.
Mm-hmm.
She's supposed to cover this story, and the story is this. A Hindu woman named Meena married a Muslim man, Abdul. So Meena's brothers burned her new husband alive because he dared to marry a Hindu woman.
Right.
And this is called an honor killing in India and probably in other Muslim countries or different countries.
Yeah.
And Meena is horribly disfigured from trying to save her husband.
Oh, man.
So her brothers did this, and her brothers are on trial, and the verdict should come out any day. So Smita does not want to cover the story, as you can imagine, but she's going to do it for her friend. And she has an interpreter, kind of companion, a man named Mohan, who's there to help drive her around. And in India, it's safer and it's more acceptable for a woman to travel with a man when you leave the more metropolitan areas. So when you go deep into the Indian countryside, you wouldn't be an Indian woman traveling by yourself. It's not something that women do there. A white woman maybe, but not an Indian woman. So the sights, the smells, the sounds of India are just so alive in this story. Absolutely loved all the descriptions of it and the food. And so just, it's so interesting because just reading about Smita, who just simultaneously loves her native land and despises it.
Mm.
And she hasn't seen it since she was a teenager. And she and Mohan drive out to the countryside to interview Meena, this woman, and her brother separately. And, it is eye-opening for how they live.
Wow.
The extreme poverty, the prejudices, the hatred. It's wild. So this book is just beautifully written. There's so many deep thoughts in here about family honor. The name of the book is Honor, about religious tolerance, the worth of women in parts of India, and also what it means to be a Western woman versus an Indian woman.
Mm.
You know, the luxuries that we take for granted in our country, that we complain about different things that are really, compared to what a lot of the women in the rest of the world have to deal with, is really not that big of a deal. It's absolutely wild. And just violence also that goes on all around the world, including our own country too. I'm not saying that our country is perfect by any means. And she does not say that at all. Against women. So it's a really important book. I think it'd be a fantastic book club book.
Mm-hmm.
I know that some of the stuff is upsetting what I talked about, but it is not like I did not cry very much really in this. I maybe had some tears, moisture. Honestly, I cried more reading the headlines on CNN today.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's a very good book. So just because it's an upsetting subject matter, don't dissuade you. So there's just so many social issues to discuss. Like if it's a book club kind of situation, I think it'd be popular.
Uh-huh.
And just a great read, you know, especially when, you know, about half the women in our country don't have the right to an abortion under any circumstances.
Right.
You know, you carry to term no matter what. And so there's that type of discussion in here as well. And it's a great starting talking point and thinking point.
Sounds like a really important book to read, and it sounds like it's written in such a way that makes it readable, and it's not out there to
She's a good writer.
Patronize the reader.
No.
Or try to, you know, get you just to cry and make
no,
it
not at all, not at all. And even at the end, I found it uplifting, very uplifting. Yeah, which is probably why I liked it. And it's called Honor. And I looked up how to pronounce her name, so hopefully I'm doing this correctly.
Yes,
3T T H R I T Y, Umrigar.
All right, very good. That is recommended by
Laura Medicus.
And my book this week,
Dave Medicus.
This is why we can't have nice things.
Is The Heavenly Table by Donald Ray Pollock. Now, this is one of my favorite genres, Southern Gothic, and it is a historical fiction, also really set in 1917. This is a grisly. It is dark. It is at times wickedly funny. It is sardonic, a tale of outcasts, misfits, set in the backwoods and small towns of northern Georgia and southern Ohio.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's man, I love this book. It's told in really short, quick chapters from multiple, many, many different perspectives. It's very much a character-driven novel in which we get to know a whole cast of characters.
Is it written in like a colloquial style?
Much of it is. Much of it is, cool. Yes. And then you see some of these characters actually get together and conflate into a big old showdown at the end. Now, like I said, a lot of characters that float in and out of this story in these short chapters. Some of my favorites include where you got a guy, and this is 1917, right? A small town. His job is to go around and inspect all the outhouses in town. So here's a guy who knows all the secrets. He even claims to know the dietary habits of all the people in the town.
I bet he does.
Because he has to inspect.
Why does he have to inspect them?
Well, to make sure they're not overflowing, especially if they're a business also.
1917, yeah.
Yeah, he's checking to make sure that, all the sanitary things are in place.
Inspecting an outhouse in 1917 isn't just an issue. I tell you, I mean, in this day and age, too, I mean, you see an outhouse. Like, yeah. I passed one today in the middle of downtown Timber, and I'm thinking, man, there is no way I'm going anywhere near that outhouse.
Right. No.
Well, here's something also interesting about this guy. He has some, what shall we say, some extra large, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. He has an extra large equipment that he carries around with him, if you know what I'm saying. In his trousers.
Yeah. So
he's got, I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie Anaconda. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie at all.
Enough, Dave.
But this guy is carrying around this
enough.
He's just embarrassed by it, so he does very strange things with it. Listen, this is this book is not for all tastes, but if you're like me, you love this kind of stuff. You have there's three brothers who, after their parents die, they're left with nothing but a Bible and an adventure book, and they end up becoming notorious murderers, bank robbers. There's a farmer who gets swindled out of his family's life savings, a military camp where kids are preparing to go off to fight in the First World War, prostitutes, and a teacher. Now, this one, actually, I told you this book is funny. This guy is on his summer break. And he's visited by a couple of characters, and he's sitting there lying in a hammock. He's reading, and then we get to hear his thoughts, and he's thinking about having to go back to school soon. And as a teacher myself, this is the line in the book that really resonated with me. I actually laughed. I don't often find myself laughing out loud at books. He thought to himself, as he's thinking about going back to school next week, might as well kill myself. slapped my knee. Even back in 1917, these teachers didn't want to get off a summer vacation. It's just the way that characters think in a Donald Ray Pollock book.
Yes. You know, and when I say to you,
yes,
teachers who get these long vacations, because it isn't just summer break. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get a winter break, you get a fall break.
Yes.
I mean,
all the major holidays.
You get a just because we can break. But you know,
those are my favorite ones.
But you know, I work a job where like. My latest job, not only do I only get 15 days off a year, we don't even get sick leave. If you take a sick day...
Try being self-employed. I got you beat.
And I've been there, okay, too.
I know.
And to you, I say to this, any you are welcome. With open arms,
I would welcome you
to come into my classroom of 34 children. And you can walk in. I will walk out, and it will be all yours all day long. And then you would say to me, Dave, you don't get enough vacation. So this book is grotesque, it is obscene, and it is unapologetic. These are characters on the brink. It really felt deeply rooted in a time and place. And this is how I like my history, to learn through fictional characters. We're always more interested than the real people, yet everything felt incredibly authentic in this one. These are people with not a lot of hope, but provided me with a great deal of entertainment. There are gunfights, there's crime, vengeance, decomposing animals, all the hallmarks of what I'm looking for in great fiction. Yes, Andrew.
So, Dave, please tell me that there's some crappy metaphors in this book.
Okay.
metaphors. All right.
Good one.
It is the heavenly... Yes, that is a good
Andrew's
one.
Andrew's perked up all of
That's
a sudden.
That's right. Yeah. The Heavenly Table by Donald Ray Pollock. Andrew! Don't stop, make it pop, DJ, blow my speakers. What do you got this week?
So my book this week...
The roof. Laura's over here raising the roof.
I don't know why. That song makes my little hands go up, yep. And I do the raise the roof motion.
As it should.
Is this your favorite part, isn't it?
No, my favorite part is the TikTok, the Kesha.
So I was driving around a car, my 7-year-old and an 8-year-old birthday this week.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was driving around, and there were four other, you know, young girls. Like, I think they're like second graders.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was driving around in my car. So I'm like, okay, what song should we put on? And of course, we had to put a Weird Al song on.
Oh, fun.
And my daughter has now influenced all of her friends.
Oh, to liking Weird Al.
To liking Weird Al. So
that's fun. That's really fun.
Yeah. So
that's great for that age group. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, and we've talked about in the show a little bit different things. You know, whether it's India or whether it's, I don't know, I'm going to go with the outhouses, but
North of Georgia.
Yeah.
But it's perspective, you know, and that's, and I think it's good. People listen to different types of music, not just popular modern music, but, you know, listen to Weird Al, who's a little bit different. It's a different perspective. You know, we all benefit from that. So my book this week, speaking of different perspectives, this book is called Space Assassins by Scott Baron. Now, what genre do we think this book is?
Space opera.
I don't know. Oh. And so I would call this sort of a hybrid genre because it is space. There are different universes. There are different worlds. But, like, the technology in this world is fueled by magic.
Oh,
really?
Yep.
Okay.
And so...
Space magic.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like when you think about, like, Star Wars. Star Wars really does have technology... But it also has magic as well.
And, oh, yeah, I guess it does.
Yeah, and I would say this book is almost more of a flip-flop, because with Star Wars, it's more technology and a little bit of magic, i.e. the Force. But in this book, it is more magic and a little lighter on the technology.
Okay.
But I like that.
Yeah.
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 No, and
I
really enjoyed this. Now, you can read the first book in this series, Space Assassins, or... As a bargain, you can go out there and you can buy the 5-book series.
Have you done that, Andrew?
I have.
Of course he has.
It's only 1,706 pages.
Wow.
That's a lot of words.
Yeah. There we go.
Yes, it is indeed.
Yeah, Paul.
A lot of words. And so 1,700.
Glorious.
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 Glorious pages.
Pages. And so, and what I will tell you as far as these books go, the first book in the series is probably not the best book in the series. Each book gets significantly better as you go through in the series. So, you know, the first book is a short book. It's only 128 pages.
Oh, that is short. Is that like a novella? Yeah.
And I'm already on deep into the second book, probably close to the end of the of the second book in the series. And so, you know, in this universe, like I said, it's magic. Magic fuels the spaceships. You're traveling, and it's interesting that. You take a magic universe that really is just a magical world, and for the most part, you're stuck in like one world, or you're stuck in a couple little towns, or some little magical kingdom, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's not the case here. I mean, here it's expansive. You're going from planet to planet. You know, you're going from, you know, and maybe it's within the same universe and the same galaxy, but it's expansive, right? And that's kind of cool. And so, the main character in the series is Hozark. And Hozark is a Gaulian assassin, And he has been raised since a young kid to be an assassin. Now, the Gaulians make great assassins because they can impersonate anybody, and they also happen to be magic vampires.
Ooh.
Oh, wow. Right? All right.
So
Laura just perked up.
So they suck the magic out of things?
They do. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, and I won't go into too much details from that, but like if they slay somebody in battle
mm-hmm.
who is magical, they will absorb their powers.
Yeah, that's cool.
Right? And there's
so they're dangerous.
Oh, and they are extremely dangerous. Yeah. They are considered like the most deadly creature.
Now, do they, in books nowadays, vampires are portrayed as like super good looking, that kind of thing? Are these assassins, is there any note about that? Or
no, and they describe
just
them.
Just out of curiosity. But
do they sparkle?
They're alien. I mean, they aren't described as being human looking.
Oh, okay, I see.
And there's all sorts of different aliens in this book. I mean, there's water breathing creatures.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, and it doesn't really get too much into the detail. It's like, but there's differences, right? There's obviously different types of creatures. And it's more about, the book describes more about the characteristics, i.e., you know, the magical characteristics or the strengths or the attributes of these different species, not necessarily so much about the looks.
Like, I gotcha.
Like, there's a little bit about that, but they're not really going into the looks in too much detail.
I feel super shallow right now.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And well, you should.
Yeah, as well, I should.
Well, you should. And so, now, when the book starts out, it's from the point of view of somebody who is the target of the assassin.
Okay.
And let's just say, and you don't really know, like, who's good or who's bad. Like, you read that first part, and you feel kind of sad that something's happened to this guy. But, you know, you quickly realize, well, he really wasn't a good guy. And so the Gaulian assassins basically, you know, like, you don't know, like, I was a little conflicted at first. Is this series about a bunch of evil assassins? Or is this book about a bunch of good assassins that are trying to keep the balance of power healthy within the universe? And yes, it is, it is a good assassin's order. They have, they basically have honor codes, and one of the quotes I love in the book is that the assassins, they value life as only one who sees death so often can. So they do not indiscriminately kill people. They're basically out there killing people for a reason. If these people actually existed in our universe, there might be a few targeted individuals in this world they would come and take out. But we are not.
Does not surprise
we're
me.
We're not going to,
right.
get more specific than that.
Okay.
So.
oh, we're whispering now.
So Hozark, he is a likable character. The characters he surrounds himself with, like ex-pirates that help them be who he wants to be. But what I would say is where the book really shines is it does not take itself too seriously. It is a great read, but it really talks about the art of the assassin.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Sounds
so
fun.
So every situation he goes into, he has to use a different skill set and a different technique to basically carry out the job. And that's where it gets into the details. You know, he's got to infiltrate a place. You know, what disguise is he going to take? You know, is it going to take 2 or 3 weeks for him to basically, you know, infiltrate that? And what's his strategy? You know, and it's the art. So, I mean, I would say this book is really more about the art of the assassin. And I think a better name for this book would, would be The Art of the Assassin, or a name for the series would be, you know, the art of the assassin. Because that, to me, is really what, is compelling, and it's really what the series is about. Hmm. But this first book is called Space Assassins by Scott Baron.
Hmm. All right, and that's recommended by Andrew Dowd, which brings us to the
Audiobook of the Week.
And my pick this week is... Now, this is a complete coincidence. My first book was set in 1917. This book is set in 1914, so we're doing a book set in the teens. This is called Endurance.
Go ahead.
No, please.
I feel like we have so much, we've talked about this, about World War II, that we don't, or even like for me, I'll read a lot about like the age of invention in the 1880s.
Yeah.
You don't hear about the teens, the 19 teens.
Right. And in the years leading up to World War One, and both these books mention World War One. No, you don't. Which is why I'm here to bring these books to you.
Thank you, Dave.
Yes, you're welcome. This is Endurance, although this is a true story. This is called, let me say Endurance one more time. Endurance Shackleton's Incredible Voyage by Alfred Lansing, narrated by Simon Preble. One of my favorite, and Simon Preble, actually the way I found this book is I looked up other books that Simon Preble narrated because he did a bunch of the Charles Paris books by Simon Brett, the great Simon Brett, who was a guest on this show. Anyway, this is the book that tells the tale of Ernest Shackleton and his attempt to reach the South Pole in 1914. So he took him and his crew of 27 men, he took them across the down the ocean there, and his ship got trapped between two gigantic ice floes. And then after the ship got really crushed between these two massive icebergs coming together, crushed the ship, they then had to travel nearly 1,000 miles across seas and land to get back, mostly seas, to get back to civilization in their smaller books. Now, the book is meticulously researched and told the author used the diaries of men who were there to tell the tale. And this is an absolutely harrowing tale.
I bet that's so good.
For nearly 2 years, these men faced just incredible hardships. Mm. The weather, the wind, the freezing conditions, the dwindling food supply. This is an epic survival story. You feel like you're right there. They all did such a great job of describing the conditions.
Sounds like a good one to listen to. Now, do they have like wind blowing or anything?
No,
sound effects?
No. Okay. I would never put if I ever turn on an audio book and there were sound effects,
really?
I throw it right out the window. Oh, there was one audio
book. Like I'm all in on that.
I started listening to. They were using music cues. Yeah. I threw it right out the window.
Okay.
You will never hear an audio book of the week with sound effects on it. For goodness sakes. It just takes away from the story. You know, you're listening for...
I totally agree with you, Dave. That's why I asked the question.
Okay. All right.
Not at all.
Anyway, The joy in listening to this book is just discovering what exactly happened to them. So I'm not going to give you any kind of spoilers that what happened. Just a great, great listen. A good old-fashioned adventure story that just so happens to be true. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Endurance, Shackleton's Incredible Voyage by Alfred Lansing.
Farther forward, the dog team drivers had attached a large piece of canvas to the port rail and made it into a sort of chute down to the ice alongside the ship. They took the 49 huskies from their kennels and slid each one down to the other men waiting below. Ordinarily, any activity of this sort would have driven the dogs mad with excitement, but somehow they seemed to sense that something very extraordinary was going on. Not one fight broke out among them, and not a single dog attempted to break away. It was perhaps the attitude of the men. They worked with a deliberate urgency, hardly speaking to one another. There was no display of alarm, however. In fact, apart from the movement of the ice and the sounds from the ship, the scene was one of relative calm. The temperature was 8.5 degrees below zero, and a light southerly wind was blowing. Overhead, the twilight sky was clear.
All right, there you go. That is your
audiobook of the week.
And that'll do it for us this week. Episode 178 in the books. Thanks so much to Mohsin Hamid for joining us. Smartest guest ever. Check out his new book, The Last White Man. Really, really good. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next time.
Adios.
Excelsior.
Isn't that weird?